Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
All these people this morning. That's right. They're missing out. All right. We're talking about more cultural values. I want to review what I'm going to be doing in the next several weeks. It's going to take a while. I'm not even through step one, but we've been talking, I think this is my fifth or sixth time, we've been talking about the different cultural values that people in biblical times held, that if we understand them, we can understand the Bible a lot better. And we're going to do some new ones this morning. And then when we're done with the cultural values, I'm going to go on to, which is something I've been studying for a while, and I'm probably as excited about it as I am about these cultural values things, is who was Jesus. We believe fully in his divinity, but we also lose sight of the fact that he was 100% human. And what was he like? What would he have been like had we known him as a person? We worship him as God, and we emulate him. We use him as our role model for teaching. But, great, do we really know what he was like? Alan?
You said he was 100% human, but was he? I mean, wasn't he, did those miracles and performed those miracles, so wasn't he part human, part God at the time? Or were the miracles performed through him by God?
No, I believe he was 100% divine and 100% human.
Amen.
He can be both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
100%
Well, anyway, we're going to get to that.
There's great things you can do if you're God.
That's right, yeah.
You'll learn it.
Yeah. It's called new math. After that, we're going to do, in light of the cultural differences, why was Jesus considered such a radical revolutionary for his time? We've lost sight of a lot of what he teaches, how it hit the people that he originally taught it to. After that, we're going to do how has what Jesus and other biblical writers influenced Western civilization and a lot of the beliefs and values that we hold now. And then after that, I'm going to talk about how those values have also influenced our political system. So it's going to take me probably a year to get there. But let's get going with the cultural values. I want to talk about three new ones. We talked about honor and shame and some other ones. I've got three of them that are all sort of tied together this morning. We're going to do something called limited good, envy, and the evil eye. I want you all to put on your imagination caps this morning and imagine that we are in first century Palestine. All of you in this room right now are the entire population of Sierra Madre. It's a small farming community in Palestine. Each of you has your own job. Many of you are masons, farmers, shepherds. Maybe one of you is a hated tax collector. I won't tell who it is. You may be weavers, town leaders, day laborers. Keep this in mind. Almost everything that we consume in this town is produced in this town. Very little is brought in. If we use it, we make it. Food, clothing. Half the children that we have in this town won't live past the age of 5. Life expectancy, any of you that are older than 35, you're living on borrowed time.
Is that 35, assuming also death by war?
Yes.
And such. So yeah. If you didn't die by a natural catastrophe or war, of course you might live into your 50s.
That's right. 60. That's right. You probably have never traveled further than Van Nuys in your entire life, or maybe Glendora going the other direction, or what's south of here, approximately?
You
certainly have never been to Long Beach. Okay? That's the scope of your world, how far you've traveled.
And we are in hell.
That's right. The food that you eat, none of it is ever wasted, because there's never quite enough to go around. You produce the food, or some of us produce the food and we buy it from each other, or we barter for it. There's rarely an excess. You have just enough, you have only enough resources through barter or purchase to obtain a few things. Most things you want, and almost most things you really want, and some things you need, you will never be able to get. Okay, that's the way our existence is. It's called subsistence living. That's a term for it. There's never not quite enough jobs. There's always a beggar or two in town. You work very hard to maintain your honor status. Remember, we talked about honor. Honor is like a commodity. You have to. It's very important in this town that everyone thinks well of you. If a woman is married from our town and goes away to another town, the family in the other town pays our family, not because she's property, although some people did think that way, but it's because the family that the woman left now has fewer ways of producing what they need. And so the money that the other family pays is a way of balancing that out. We're taking a person who produces for you, we will pay you an amount of money.
You're talking a dowry or
yes.
An ongoing amount?
No, a dowry. Now, given all of that, tell me how would you feel if someone, if John here, breaks into your house at night and steals some of your food?
I'd feel great.
Yes.
Don't.
What feeling would that create?
Animosity.
Yeah.
Okay. Why?
Threat to your existence.
Can't you just go buy more food?
No.
Right. How would you feel if someone bribed another to get a job? How would you feel if somebody lied about their family lineage, claiming they were a descendant of David, and find out that they are not? They're not the honorable person.
I would be ticked.
Yes, you would. How would you feel if somebody simply worked harder and longer every day, instead of working 10-hour days, they worked 12-hour days to earn a little bit more money to be able to buy more food for their family? Would that be in this culture, we think of that as a reasonable thing. How would we feel about that in this town? What would happen to the extra food that person can buy? It's taken away from someone else, isn't it?
Well, the other person could have worked too.
So what if everybody worked hard, worked an extra 2 hours to buy more food?
If they're a farmer, they're producing, and so it's okay.
But there's only enough to go around for everyone.
Still the same amount, no matter how long anybody works.
That's right. How would you feel if someone, if John here, inherited a pile of money from a deceased uncle in another town, and all of a sudden he had enough money to buy pretty much anything he wanted that was produced in the town? What feelings would you have about that?
I'd try to produce the perfect murder.
That's right.
I probably had my job.
Nothing personal.
Remember.
But on the other one, Mike, if you worked harder, you could maybe buy a donkey. When you're going to travel to Van Nuys, somebody in another town in Van Nuys, you could buy that from them. So it doesn't mean that you're just, it's a closed system that you can't bring things in. That if you baked for 2 hours more and sold it down into Glendora, you couldn't get.
But those guys in Van Nuys, they're limited in what they can produce, too.
Well, you know, I don't believe that. It's not like you don't have more wheat or that you can't produce something that make more.
Alan?
Well, I think what you're describing, I was in Israel a long time ago. It's a kibbutz, I think, is what you're sort of describing. A kibbutz is a... I don't know if you know what that is. It's a like a communal farm or factory, where they all produce toward the end of the towards the community. Everybody lives on the community, and they may get paid a little bit, I'm not sure, but everything goes towards the community. So they have enough food to eat, they have enough of this, that, and everything is towards that.
Where I'm going with that is that plus what I'm getting at now. So yes, but it's more than that. How would you feel if someone, John here's got all this money now, and he decides there's some other people in town who have not done well with their farms, and John's got the money to pay them for their farmland, and he starts increasing the size of his holdings. What's that going to do to everybody's mindset?
Watch out for him.
Right. And if Lee over here is the poor guy who sold it to John, and in a couple of years the money that you paid Lee starts to run out, how are you going to feel about that, Lee?
I think we ought to ship John over to Van Nuys.
Or he'd ask me for a job.
That's right.
Put him to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the deal. I mean, like, say you had kids, you might go, oh, yeah, sons, we'll marry our daughter and kind of see if, I mean, see if we can make an arrangement. I mean, I kind of see how that came up.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, like I said, you know, does he have any work extra that he could pay now that he's rolling in?
How much are you going to pay him, John? Are you going to pay him a fair wage?
Of course.
Why would you do that?
Because he lives there.
Did anybody else work for him?
But you're becoming a wealthy landowner. You don't have to pay him a fair wage. You pay him whatever he'll work for.
But not by cheating him, just by providence.
Okay.
Doesn't the law require that, the Jewish law requires that he gets paid a fair wage?
Yes, but a fair wage was a subsistence wage.
But then, I think if somebody has more kids, I mean, you've got to say that there's more, enough wheat. If somebody has 10 kids, it isn't like there's not enough wheat because there's only a closed amount of things. I mean, then am I going to be mad at them because they have 10 kids and I have two?
No, because those 10 kids are all working their brains out to produce.
There's a closed system that you can't gain anything more within it. What are they eating?
But they're eating everything they're producing. So any extra they produce, they're consuming it. There's almost nothing left over. After everyone produces what they produce and we all consume it, there's almost nothing left over.
What happens when the 10 kids grow up, the father dies? Where do they go when the land passes to the oldest son?
Well, you have to remember that the life expectancy was low. Half of those sons will probably not make it past 5 or 6.
But even if there's one,
well, the world population does increase to some extent. The towns do get slightly larger, and they do spread out. But it doesn't increase when, I don't know the numbers, but I'm imagining that if any two married people produced an average of 2.1 offspring, it wouldn't increase very quickly. That's true.
More.
That's true.
And I mean, if you have limited resources, you could say, well, they can just expand out. But if they don't have the money to buy the land, and what about the allotments that went to each family according to, you know, the tribe?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know a lot of the money that you all make is sent to Rome. 15% is sent to Rome as tax, and you all resent the Romans because you barely have enough to eat as it is. I don't know the answer to that. I think that if you look at the world population at the time, it was fairly static. It was not increasing exponentially like it is now, because famine, disease, war, and just a very short lifespan. There weren't people. It wasn't like our population is going to go up 10% in the next 10 years like some towns do now. It might go up, I don't know, 0.5%, something like that.
This reminds me of when Christ performed the miracles of the 5 fish or 2 fish, and they collected 12 baskets, you know, leftovers. You know, they probably took it home. The Bible doesn't say that. I always wondered.
leftovers, they put them in their refrigerator. How would you feel if someone from another city, say Evo Pasadena over here, came and took a job in town and took the money and went back to Pasadena every night? My point with this is there's a sociological phenomenon called the idea of limited goods. It's the idea, and I don't know that the people in Palestine at the time would have explained it that way, but subconsciously the mindset was anything of value, anything you want, anything you need, whether it's money, land, clothing, women, jobs, was in limited supply. There was not an unlimited supply like we think of now. You break something now, you go buy a new one. Remember, at that time, people were subject to nature. We still have not mastered nature, but we like to think we have now. So, because we were subject to nature, we were not even thinking in terms of increasing quantities of production or trying to make ourselves better. Now, here's one of the main points. An individual can increase any of those things that I just mentioned only by another's decrease. Okay? So, balance can be maintained only by keeping the existing arrangements or statuses, which almost everyone will do willingly. And the reason we do it willingly is because we don't want to feud with each other. If you start buying land and you make too much of a spectacle of that, you are simply going to be ostracized by everybody else in when you go to buy food, when you try to find a wife, when you try to buy clothing, in just your social relations at the temple or in the marketplace. An honorable man would only be interested in what is rightfully his. And what is rightfully his is what he can buy with the money that he honestly makes, maintaining his social status from the time he was born. Remember, our existence is limited by nature and the physical and social resources of the village. So, conclusion with that is all things desired in life are limited. Now, to try to drive this point home a little bit more, can you think of anything in our current world, back to 21st century America, can you guys think of anything where that limited good mindset, where we, any places where we think of things in that way?
The immigration issue.
How so?
Some people think that immigrants will take jobs away rather than.
Very good. There's a limited number of jobs, and if people come from outside to take those jobs, we're all going to be hurt by it. Excellent.
Limited number of iPad 2s. They just had a big fight in Beijing over the iPad 2s.
Excellent.
Well, just in our whole tax debate in this country, some people say, well, these wealthy need to give it up to those poor because there's this pot and it needs to be shared. So it's a zero-sum game.
That's right.
In that mindset.
Yeah.
Instead of, those people are wealthy, wouldn't it like be great to bring up the poor and increase their well-being? Without saying that in order to do that, you need to take it from them, because otherwise there's no source.
Yeah, zero-sum game is a good way to put it. What else? Anybody else think of one? How about the whole environmental movement? You know, we're afraid of running out of oil. And how is that? How does that subtly change our mindset? When we see somebody on the freeway with an SUV, or somebody with a 6,000 square foot house, or those kinds of things, some of us, not all of us, there's a mindset in this country that's starting to develop that that's wrong, that there's something inherently immoral or even evil about that, because we're taking, you know, that SUV that gets eight miles to the gallon could be replaced with a Prius with a one cylinder engine, and you know,
by force.
That's right, and they would be doing their honorable thing for the environment. in this recession, I think we started thinking about that way with jobs. You know, there's only so many jobs to go around. How about anybody who's a sports fan? Sports championships. You know, Lakers doesn't look like they're going to do it this year. And there's a little bit of a bad feeling about that if you are a Lakers fan. Who's going to win it? And whoever wins it, they get to claim it for a year until maybe we can try again next year. But there's only one championship to be had by 30 NBA teams. Is there one word that you can think of that would sum up your feelings in that sort of sum up how the feelings that we're talking about if someone takes something that isn't theirs?
Unfair?
It's not a feeling word. Being a psychologist. Can you give me a feeling word?
Discontent.
Okay, keep going.
Resentment,
that's close.
Envy.
Envy, who said it? Very good. That's the word I would use. That's the word the Bible uses.
Envy.
Who can tell me the difference between envy and jealousy?
Alan.
We're envious that you know the answer.
You've been waiting for this for years. Right? No, because I watched the Seven Deadly Sins on TV, and they actually talked about envy and jealousy. Now, from what I remember, envy. Jealousy is if you're basically jealous of a person. In other words, if I'm married, and some guy comes along and flirts with my wife, so I would be jealous of my wife. No, jealous of him or jealous of my wife? No, jealous of if my wife. No, I'd be jealous of my wife that he's paying attention. Now, envy is more, I think, material things. I'm envious of you. I want to be like you. I want to be. Whereas jealousy is more of a possessive type of thing.
Ted?
Jealousy is when you suspect or you're angry at somebody for taking what belongs to you. Mm-hmm. Envy is when you want what belongs to somebody else. Right.
That's correct.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah, I know. Very good. And are you envious of his answer?
Yes, actually I am. No. Because it showed me up to be the fool that I really am.
Envy is a natural result of a limited goods outlook on life. If anybody threatens what you have, you are going to be envious of them. Jesus was a threat to the social status quo. There were only so many religious leaders in town. We have the temple. We don't like that being messed with. And here comes this guy named Jesus who was a threat to the religious structure of Palestine. So let's read a verse here that might make a little more sense now that we understand this idea. Matthew 27:17. So when the people gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release you to, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that because of envy they had handed him over. Jesus was a threat to the structure of the time. He was seen as taking honor that was not due him. So people were envious and they wanted to get rid of him. Let's read a few more verses that deal just generally with envy and jealousy. Job 5:2. For anger slays the foolish man, and envy kills the simple. Psalm 37:1. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious towards wrongdoers. Now, when you read these, what I get from these is we can understand these easily in our 21st century way of thinking. We don't want to be envious. But this sort of adds a layer to it. This means that these people they actually saw their way of life being threatened when they were envious. Okay, I may say to somebody, you know, I really love that car that Dave's got and I want one of those cars. Well, I probably could just go out and buy one if I really wanted it. But if Dave had the only one that Toyota or whoever ever produced, and he had it, my feelings about that, if I loved cars, if I loved his car, would be a little bit different. Be a little more envious. So when the Bible talks about envy, it's talking about it in a way that's a little more urgent, a lot more of a powerful feeling than we're used to. Psalm 73, 3, "For I was envious of the arrogant, and I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Now, do you notice that there's an equation here between prosperity and wicked? When we hear the word wicked, what do we think of? What if I called someone a wicked person? How do we think? What does that mean? What did they do? What's wrong with them?
Violent.
Okay.
Self-centered.
Okay.
Exploiting. Abusive.
Mm-hmm. Abusive. Exploitive. Interesting you say that, because you're the rich farm, the rich landowner. Okay, I want to expand the definition. Here's another one. When the Bible talks about wicked, we could also say someone who's greedy. Now, would John, who is buying up everybody's land in town, because he can, would we consider him greedy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, here in Psalm 73, they're equating the wicked with prosperity. "As I saw the prosperity of the wicked." So anyone who's grasping for something that's not theirs. John wasn't born into a family that had all this land. He wants this land for himself. He's wicked because he's being greedy, because he's purchasing things. Now, he's not doing anything illegal, but he's not staying within the social status that we all expect him to. We know his parents. We know his grandparents. We know his lineage back probably 10 generations. We know where he should be socially. And he's not staying there. And he's become a threat. Therefore, he is wicked.
Would you say the definition of wicked is Bernie Madoff?
Bernie Madoff?
Madoff.
Yeah. No? Sure.
But if he's greedy in a way, what would be wicked is if he's hurting the lives of everybody else around him.
That's right.
You can be prosperous, but not at everybody else's expense.
See, that's excellent, because in a limited good way of thinking, there is no way for you to be prosperous where it doesn't cost somebody else something, at least in the way they think about it.
In the way they think.
That's right. In our culture, if you make a pile of money and you can retire early and buy a big house, we're all, you know, we may be a little envious, but all of us might would probably say we're happy for you. We don't feel like it cost us personally for you
but
to do that.
If they are doing it in a crooked or a wrong way, you know, we're not envious. We aren't happy for them. It's got to be in an honest way that you're doing it.
That's right.
And not hurting.
And my point is, there was no honest way to do it in a limited good mentality.
Wouldn't it be situational, though? Like, what if he inherited all this money and he was actually really giving towards the community and, you know, shared and was generous?
Sure.
Then
yeah.
Nobody would think he's wicked, even though he still had the same pot of money.
Yeah, we might still suspect him. What if he just stopped giving to the poor all of a sudden?
That's true.
Yeah.
What about the example of Job, who was, you know, very wealthy and also very righteous and was recognized for it? Yet you see the hint of envy when his friends deal with what's afflicting him. They're telling him, well, the only reason you can be going through this is you've got some secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of indicates maybe they had a part of envy for him
right.
as well.
Very good. Yeah.
I have trouble with that wicked thing. What's the word that before the fall these people were reprobates?
Yeah.
That
right.
And I wouldn't put Madoff in a reprobate type of person. Wicked would be a reprobate.
I don't think the word.
Madoff.
He's saying he's always equated the word wicked with a reprobate. But
what
I don't.
Does reprobate mean?
Reprobate means beyond the capacity of God to redeem you. In other words, you have chosen evil in so many times, in so many ways, for so long that God no longer, you're lost. You're permanently lost. And now Hugh teaches, right, totally wicked. Hugh teaches that there are very, very few truly reprobate people.
Today.
Right. Now, I've never equated the word wicked with reprobate, so that's an interesting idea. I'm not sure. I don't think the Bible uses it that way. Is that how you've always heard it?
No, I'm just thinking wicked would be, really something that's beyond. He's just a wicked person. He's trying to do everybody. And,
yeah. But I don't know that that means he's beyond God's capacity to redeem him, to get a hold of him.
Yeah, but well, reprobate is, like you were saying, like in Sodom and Gomorrah,
right.
There was nobody who didn't think that as soon as they saw somebody, they wanted to at least ravage them.
What's the passage in Genesis about the people before the flood? Every thought was continually evil all the time. That's reprobate. And
well, since Jesus died for our sins, can anybody be reprobate?
Oh, I think so. I think you can choose to rebel against God to the point where you can't be redeemed.
Yeah, we could.
Okay.
But since Jesus died for the sins of all of us, can we say, does the Bible describe anybody as having been reprobate after?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't want to hang up too much on reprobation. So if you've got other questions, let's go on with those. Yes, Barbara.
So your Bible verse, which I can't remember exactly your wording, but you read the verse and you said it equates prosperity with wicked. But I don't think that's what the Bible verse says. I think the Bible verse says when we see a wicked person prosper, then we get upset.
Right.
But I don't think that's saying we're equating prosperity and wickedness.
Well, in our way of thinking, I see what you're saying, and I know it's not ironclad. In our way of thinking, a wicked person could be a relatively poor person. Mm-hmm. Okay? But listen to the way the verse is structured. As I saw the prosperity of the wicked.
Yeah, I think what she's saying, that's what that verse is saying. I saw that the wicked would prosper.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think that verse upsets. Either upset, you know, why do good things happen to bad people and bad things? You know, it's that question.
Right.
It's not saying because I'm prosperous, I'm wicked.
Okay. Yet that is the point I'm trying to make.
We see that, though, we're definitely upset.
Right. Because go back to, you know, we all live in this town. If any of us do well, it's going to cost the other person. That's how you're going to see it.
I always thought it was when you see wicked people do well materially, they obtain that wealth by dishonorable means or unethical means.
Well, I think.
And here am I obeying all the rules, and here's what I have, and here's this person has so much more, but they got it by unethical means, and it seems like they're getting away with it.
Well, here's.
So I think that's how I interpreted the wicked and the rich.
I think this is part of the miracle of the Bible, is that it can apply and be understood in two completely different cultural systems. We read it now with no understanding of the culture of the time, and it still makes sense. There's another way to look at it. You can imagine how someone who prospered in a small town could be seen as wicked because he was taking from everyone else. John?
Well, I was looking at clarifying the matter of reprobate. A person who, with suitable knowledge and understanding, absolutely, adamantly, irrevocably rejects the grace offered by the Messiah would be in that classification. So it's a very high standard, but it is possible.
Well, and add to that, and has rejected it so vehemently that it is irretrievable, that he cannot, he will not later go back and claim it.
Yeah, he's demonstrated his will in such that, by his own will, he would never accept that.
That's correct. That's how I see it. Proverbs,
I have a question. If
there was a man who was rich and he was helping out the society, but he had to kill a man to get the money he was using. How would he be thought of as wicked?
Yes. Yeah, because murder was wrong. Everyone knew murder was wrong. I think that's the same today. It's one of those situations where you try to figure out if somebody is good or bad who does a bad thing for a good end. It's an interesting question in psychology.
Even in your limited culture about the wicked and the rich, I think it still boils down to the line of reasoning that the rich people had to employ unethical means, meaning taking away resources from other people, to be able to get rich.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the richness so much that's the subject of being wrong. It's the methodology by which you got there, I think, is critical.
I think that that's mostly true, but there is a component, I think, from what I'm understanding, to reaching for something that was not yours by inheritance. Your goal to maintain the status quo is to live as honorably as you can in the social status that you were born into. The very act of trying to improve yourself out of that social status will be seen as greedy.
And then Christ's parables of taking the master's talents and multiplying them would have been considered what by Christ's hearers?
It would have been considered thievery, greedy. It would have been considered they're grasping for something that they have no right to.
It's Christ. The parable obviously
commend.
Not in a positive fashion.
Well, that's why, and that's where we're going. Once we establish some of these values, then we can go to what Jesus taught and we can see why what he taught was so radical in relation to the culture. And that's for future weeks.
I think back then, though, it was not totally an equal-sum culture. For example, God blessed a number of people, and if everything stays the same, but all of a sudden my animals start to really multiply, that isn't taken away from the community. In fact, it's added because now I need to hire somebody to help me from watch these things.
Yeah, in reality, it's not a mathematical formula that works out perfectly every time. What we're trying to say here is this is the perception. This is how people basically thought about things that were needed in a culture like this. A thief was someone who stole not just material goods, but honor, heritage, and that kind of thing. So I think we've understood that. Let me read a couple more verses. Proverbs 23, "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always. Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off." In other words, I like this last two lines. He's saying, don't be envious. Even if somebody does something to get something they don't deserve, there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Proverbs 24:1, "Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them." Proverbs 24:19, "Do not fret because of evildoers, or be envious of the wicked." So, acquisition by its very nature would be regarded as stealing. Here's a quote from the time, from a guy named St. Jerome. St. Jerome said, "Every rich person is a thief or the heir of a thief." Okay, so that's a quote.
So was Solomon a thief? David a thief?
And Abraham?
Abraham a thief?
He was rich.
There certainly would, my argument is there certainly would have been a part of the way people thought about them that would have included that. But if they were honorable people, generous people, men of God, besides that, that may have been not the dominant feeling about them.
It was also the place of the king to be wealthy and powerful.
That's true. That's right.
So
yeah.
It wouldn't have had exactly the same sense for the king to be wealthy and powerful and to exert that authority as an agent of God in a theocracy. And so, but the rest of the people certainly would be bothered if one of their peers acted like the king when he wasn't the king.
Right. The king's expected to act like a king because that's the social status that he was born into. And he's maintaining that social status. Or he was a powerful guy and he, in battle, fought his way to the kingship, which is also an honorable way to do it.
What about Job once he was restored?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because someone thinks you're evil doesn't mean you're evil. You're not evil. Who else?
Well, that's true. That's true.
You're talking about people's perception.
I'm talking about people's perception. And when we read the Bible, it's important to understand how the people who these books were written to directly, how they would have understood it, and what the writers of the documents would have meant when they wrote it. And all I'm trying to do is say there's more meat here. There's more stuff that we can, as we read it, there's different ways that we can understand it. So acquisition by its very nature would be regarded as stealing. Okay? Remember that there's no middle class, too. So to better yourself would have been to bring yourself up into something that doesn't really exist. 98% of people were poor, very poor, subsistence living. There were maybe 2 or 3% that really had enough money to do what they wanted with. Noblemen, also people that worked in the temple, who were all very often, we were very envious of them because we know that they got the money that they got by taxing us for the temple and then using it in a way that was not really for the Lord, for God's work. They were using it for themselves and kings and that kind of thing. So let's try to redefine the word poor. When the Bible uses the word poor, we think almost completely in terms of money. When the Bible uses the word rich, we think almost completely in terms of money. But there's a bigger picture to that. You could redefine poor to say lacking in honor, socially unfortunate. Rich would be greedy, powerful. Okay, so we gives you a bigger picture of who those redefines that. I want to go on to something called, who has questions about that?
Quick question. Because I'm thinking, what if, people, since it's perceptions, that people could be envious of people for all sorts of things. Your kids are misbehaving, their kids are acting nicely, your spouse has better health or
right.
Whatever. You know, there's a lot of things that you just can't help but people think. But
remember, in our first century Palestine culture, what people, we talked about this before, my identity, the way I think about myself, who I am, I don't think about myself in an individualistic way. So I can't, there's no such thing as being able to say, I'm going to do the right thing no matter what anybody else thinks. Those are opposite things in our mindset. I am doing the right thing. I know that I am doing the right thing only if you all approve of me. If I have honor that you bestow on me. Okay? You are doing the right thing. You are an honorable person only if we all grant you honor. So if the greedy landowner over here starts a rumor about you that's not true, you're going to do everything you can to fight to maintain that honor. You'll probably start spreading some rumors about him. See, so this way of life is it's not a peaceful way of life.
Yeah, it's for kind and generous things.
There's a lot of bickering.
More likely to challenge to a duel. That was the more common way to solve those things.
Yeah. Other than money, what other way could people be nonconformist in that situation?
You could try to fit into social circles that you had no right to. You could try to fit into social circles of people that were above you in social rank. You could try to work a lot harder to make more money than you deserved. Okay.
Not money involved in socially acceptable.
don't know if that's the contradiction.
You could try to get a husband from a from a city or a tribe that was of higher social rank, and you would not have a right to do that. You could wear clothing that was not appropriate for your social rank, and you would be seen as a pretender, an imposter. You would lose your honor rating would go down if you did those kinds of things. Does that make sense?
In the Old Testament, in the Torah, there were provisions for kind of an economic reset periodically. Year of Jubilee.
The Jubilee, yeah.
Slaves had to go free, debts disappeared, and kind of start over. Now, in the time of Jesus, we got a lot of observant Jews living in Palestine, and he certainly took the Torah seriously as he possibly could. What did they do with those provisions?
That's a good question, and I don't know enough to know the answer to that.
The Jews followed those provisions for only a few years. Mm-hmm. They abandoned them very quickly, within a century or so.
See, and if you think about... That makes a lot of sense to do that, because let's go back to John and Lee. John's buying Lee's land. John pays him money. Lee, in a couple of years, is destitute because he's run out of the money that John paid him. The Jubilee idea, the idea of bringing things back to the way they were, is a way of preventing there being two or three people like John in town and everybody else destitute like Lee, because it resets. It resets the system after 50 years or whatever it was.
Is the Jubilee 7 years? Is that supposed to be 7?
No,
50. It was 7 of 7 plus one more Jubilee year.
You know, I think about the story of Ruth and Naomi. Somebody that was a kinsman had to marry Ruth so that the property that Naomi's family had would pass down to those heirs. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of those cultural things so that people, like John didn't come along and buy that real estate from them.
That's right.
That they legitimately pass that down to the family.
Yeah, very good. I got a few minutes left, and I want to get onto this one called the evil eye, because this thing fascinates me. I think it's so bizarre. I'm gonna be a first century Hugh Ross here for a couple of minutes, okay? And I'm gonna tell you about what was believed about the physics of the time. I'm gonna talk about the nature of light. What I'm gonna tell you is that light is something that exists by itself. Darkness is also something that exists by itself. Now, I've heard people say that darkness is the absence of light. That's absolutely not true. They are two different things that exist independently of each other. Okay? Both are positive entities that have no relation to any external source like the sun, the moon, candles, etc. Okay? This is what we all believe. Sight, our ability to see, comes from the light that's inside us, or there's a fire in there. And it emanates. We see things because of what comes out of our eyes. And I can see John standing over there with his teacup because of the fire that's inside of me that comes up through my heart and out through my eyes and hits John, and I perceive that. Okay? Now, this is fascinating, and I can't describe it as well as this, so I'm gonna read something out of here. For the ancient Mediterranean, all of us, light is the presence of light, and darkness is the presence of darkness. Thus, the sun does not cause daylight, nor does the moon or stars cause light at night. Day and night were simply the structured framework in which the sun and moon operated. Notice that in Genesis, the sun, moon, and stars were created after the creation of light and darkness. There's a different way of looking at that passage. While the sun and moon marked the changing of the seasons, they had no influence on the seasons any more than they influenced day or night. The relative darkness of winter was due to the cloudy sky, not to the low path of the sun. In fact, the sun was noted for its warmth rather than its light. Light was presence due to the presence of light itself, not the presence of the sun. This meant that the onset of celestial light over the land was the dawn, and the coming of celestial darkness over the land was dusk, not sunrise and sunset. I'll give you a quote from Plutarch. Plutarch says, "Man both experiences and produces many effects through his eyes. He is possessed and governed by either pleasure or displeasure exactly in proportion to what he sees." Interesting. Since all living beings have light, light and life go hand in hand. In this perspective, all light and life have their origin in the creative work of God alone. They can be handed on by human beings, but not created by them. Therefore, I, as Hugh Ross, assure you that all the stars and everything that creates light in the heavens, is all of those are a living being because they produce light. How else could they produce light if they weren't living? Ted.
In fact, you can prove that, physicist that you are, because if you put something in shadow from the sun, you can still see it.
That's right.
Therefore, there's still light without the sun.
Very good.
Striking that object.
You need a job. You can be my assistant. Now, here's where it ties into what we've been talking about. Envy, which is a feeling within us, thus proceeds from the heart through the eyes. So what they believed was that whatever was inside of us, whatever we were feeling, our innermost nature, came out through the eyes. I'm looking at John, I'm envious of him, he's buying my land. I'm feeling envious of John. Okay? And that envy comes, which starts in my heart, goes through my eyes, and I'm giving him what?
The evil eye.
I'm giving him the evil eye. Envy thus proceeds from the heart through the eyes. The usual suspects thought to harbor evil eye abilities were family members, strangers, outsiders, and deviants, as well as the physically deformed, disabled, and the blind. Now let's talk about the blind for a minute. We all know, everybody in town knows, that a blind person is blind because he is such a sinner that God has taken, his heart is so defective that it no longer has the physical ability to send out light and see things. Does anybody know of a verse that talks about that?
The fullness alone.
John.
This man or his parents?
Yeah.
John 9:1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him." But that's what we believe.
One of the amazing things about the Bible, obviously, is this type of, you know, plots and things, obviously. I mean, there were those and other various ones you learn about, obviously. It's amazing that we didn't get those crazy things, you know, into the Bible, obviously. Which is just one of the astounding things, obviously, of just how the Bible is God-inspired, that God made sure the prophets, obviously, you know, put truth in there and didn't wind up with all of these, you know, wise tales and things, because, I mean, this is just one of them. You go back and read the history and through that culture, there were tons of things like that.
Right.
Of wise tales and beliefs, obviously, and then later on, even the apostles even said, you know, beware of, you know, wise tales, you know, and stay with the gospel, you know.
So in other words,
even the apostles obviously knew that there were just lots of foolish ideas out there, you know, and you know, making sure don't put this in the church, don't make sure it doesn't get into your scriptures, you know, stay to the word of God.
Very good.
What I was thinking about when you started talking about light was that part of 1 John where it said, "And the light came into the world, and where in him there was no darkness." And I was looking for a Bible to see exactly what that verbiage was, but I would want to see how that stacked up against what you were sharing right there. I don't know if you...
I haven't looked into that, and I... light was seen as a good thing, but something independent that operated on its own. It came out of us. So I would imagine that is the life that's within God that's coming out of his eyes and is bestowed on us. The association of Evil eye and envy is typical of ancient Mediterraneans. Israelite tradition, for example, is full of warnings against persons with the evil eye. The person with a good eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor, from Proverbs. And then there's several quotes here from Sirach. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. It's an apocryphal writing. Some people believed it to be an inspired writing, but it has always been rejected from the Old Testament canon. But it's from the time, and there's a lot of quotes from Sirach that talk about the evil eye. And I'll just read a few. Evil is the man with an evil eye. He averts his face and disregards people. An evil-eyed man is not satisfied with a portion, and mean injustice withers the soul. An evil-eyed man begrudges bread, and it is lacking at his table. Remember that an evil eye is a bad thing. What has been created more evil than the eye? It sheds tears from every face. So the glance and even the presence of such an individual were to be avoided because he or she was thought to have the power of injuring and or destroying with his look. Okay? And they wore all kinds of amulets and things to protect themselves from evil eye. So that if you know, John has an evil eye because he's a greedy landowner, and I'm walking past him, I may do something to try to distract his gaze, or wear some really brightly colored thing that would distract him. He would look at that instead of giving me the evil eye, because I might get sick or even die if he gets
sick. Could go over real good.
Yeah. That's true.
I'm going back in time.
Okay. I want to read. Okay. I'm running. What's that?
That's Greek. She said it was Greek.
That's right.
I'm going to go back in time and sell something.
She said it was Greek.
Readers of the Bible are often unaware of the presence of evil eye belief in Scripture because of faulty translation. So I'm going to read you a few verses to talk about the evil eye that are usually quoted as envy or greed. In Matthew 6:22 and also Luke 11:34, Jesus says, "The eye is the lamp of the body." So if your eye is generous, sometimes translated as healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is evil, sometimes translated as unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Later, Jesus mentioned the evil eye in the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, Matthew 20:15. The landowner asks the worker, "Do you have the evil eye?" Revised Standard Version translates that, "Are you envious?" instead of "Do you have the evil eye?" But the literal translation is, "Do you have the evil eye? Do you have the evil eye because I am generous?" According to the Gospel of Mark, Jesus, in a dispute with the Pharisees over the issue of purity in Mark 7:1-23, lists the evil eye in Mark 7:22, among a group of evil things that emerge from the human heart and thereby pollute a person. Note that Paul in Galatians 3:1 uses the concept as well, "O foolish Galatians, who has put the evil eye on you," sometimes translated as "bewitched you," "before whose eyes Jesus Christ was proclaimed as crucified."
Was it like a curse?
Yeah, it's basically, they didn't see it as a curse. They saw it as, if you think of me as having an evil eye, you believe that I am envious of you, or I wish you evil. And because that evil in my heart is connected to my eyes, and when I look at you, the way that I can see you is because what's in my heart is coming up through my eyes and out, and I'm aiming it at you by looking at you, and it hits you. So the evil eye is an actual physical manifestation of my bad intentions towards you. If I am envious of you, I can injure you with the particles that come out of my heart through my eyes and strike you.
Particle theory.
Yes.
I think the Italians called it the Pinocchio or something, and it was that thing. This was the evil eye. They wear them on their thing.
That's right.
Because they would get cursed or something.
Well, wouldn't that be like intimidation? Maybe you're intimidating somebody the way you look at them, and that creates
apprehension or fear. But also in the Jewish tradition, isn't there a, I think my grandmother did this when I was born, but when a baby is born, doesn't the grandmother go like that, which means get rid of the evilness?
I don't know that,
or
yeah.
Or she was just spitting on me.
I think it was the latter.
But I do remember something like that, that there was it's a superstition,
yeah,
that they want to get rid of the evil.
Okay, now, because of this belief about the evil eye and this belief that I can actually affect someone by the condition of my heart in a physical way, not in the way you're talking about. If I look at you, you know, like I'm jealous of you, you may say you're jealous, but I'm not physically injuring you. We're talking about a physical injury, like me shooting a gun and killing you. That's how effective a person with an evil eye could be. There was actual particles, actually things coming from my heart through my eyes aimed at your skull, and tomorrow you're going to get a disease or maybe you'll die. That's how strong the belief in the evil eye is. So I got no time left, but I'm going to finish this. What the point I want to make here is, in biblical times, and the way these people thought about it was, there was a direct physical connection between the heart and the eyes. And I want to do a few verses that talk about the eyes and the heart work together. So it wasn't the power of the eye that gives you the evil eye, but the condition of my heart. Whatever's in my heart is going to come through my eyes. Ephesians 1:18. I pray, listen to this connection. It makes more sense now that you understand this. I pray that the eyes of your heart, what does that mean if we don't understand this? The eyes of your heart may be enlightened so that you will know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. 1 Corinthians 2:9. Things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. Isaiah 6:10. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, and their eyes dim. Otherwise they may see with their eyes, hear with their hearts, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. Proverbs 15:30. Bright eyes gladden the heart. So there's the opposite effect. If you are a person of good repute, a person with good intent.
So is that how, can you explain that's how maybe Jesus did do some miracles? Because of the goodness of his heart coming through his eyes? And then, no, I mean, this is how it could be the opposite. I mean, if something's evil in your heart, goes through your eyes to that person, the opposite, is that how Jesus may have conducted miracles?
Well, there's nothing that we understand about physics right now that would be able to explain that. So we call it a miracle. I can't imagine that there's anything really to this other than, like John said, if I look at John with disdain or envy, I may injure you simply emotionally, but there's no, in our understanding, there's no physical harm to that. Let me get through these verses. Proverbs 15:30 again, bright eyes gladden the heart, good news puts fat on the bones. Proverbs 21:4, haughty eyes and a proud heart, the lamp of the wicked is sin. There's that light thing again. Job 31:1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Jeremiah 22:17. But your eyes and your heart, there it is again, are intent only upon your own dishonest gain and on shedding innocent blood and on practicing oppression and extortion. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much. Yeah. Lord God, we thank you so much that we can understand the Bible in terms from our time here, the 21st century, and it makes so much sense to us and helps us so much. But if we really understand the culture of the people that it was written to and the people who wrote it, that there's even more truth to be gleaned. And we ask that we never look at this in just an intellectual way, that it's always about your love and a better relationship with you and being able to pass our faith on to other people. in a spirit of humility and kindness and love. Thank you. Bless everybody as they go their way today. In Jesus' name, amen.